Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Ellen Burstyn, who reads from and discusses her memoir, Lessons in Becoming Myself, published by Riverhead. In the weeks to come, we have James McGreevy, Sina Jeter Naslund, T.A. Barron, Barack Obama, Eric Larson, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. We have a very special evening planned this evening, but before we get to the second introduction, critic-at-large Greg Moody has been with CBS Channel 4 for 17 years. He has won 12 regional Emmy Awards for his commentary and writing, and he is also the producer of the Emmy Award-winning show. Greg is also the best-selling author of 5 Mysteries, which makes it all the more appropriate that he's with us tonight to interview Ellen Burstyn. Would you please join me in welcoming Greg Moody?
Ladies and gentlemen, you are in for a treat tonight, and it is certainly not me. It is an honor to be here and an honor to do this tonight because I have watched this performer's career for 50 years. I remember watching her on television in various episodes and then an astounding movie career doing some of the great movies of the last 30 and 40 years. But what strikes me as even more wonderful is getting the chance to read this book and discover the places that it took me. And I can't wait to talk to her. I know you would like to hear her speak as well. So please, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Academy Award winner and Tony Award winning actress Ellen Burstyn. What I discovered about this book as I read it and would like to chat to you about is that it was not at all what I was expecting. It was not a, let's say, standard Hollywood or performing biography. Then I went and did this, and then I went and did that, and then I had this job, and then I had that job. Everything in here is of a very personal nature. Everything in here is very honest, sometimes brutally so.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
And also, it is not just about where you've been and what you've done, but the journey you've taken. Mm-hmm. How difficult was it to reach that deeply into yourself and be that honest and be that open about even your spiritual journey through life?
Well, it was difficult. On the other hand, I feel like it would have been more difficult if I tried to be dishonest, because the whole point of telling the book, of writing the book and telling the stories, was to say that bad things happen to people. Bad things happen to children. And those bad things can form character in a way that the people then go on repeating those traumas over and over and over. And we don't have to do that. At a certain point, we can decide to change, to really set out to make conscious decisions about who we want to be. I mean, the best example before us right now is Congressman Foley, who wrote those salacious emails to young people And then he went into rehab. And once in rehab, he sent out a message that he had been molested by a priest. And sure enough, the priest came forward and said, yes, that's true. Well, it is true that when someone is molested or has any kind of trauma, that they repeat that. They keep on acting out that trauma over and over. But we also have the ability to take responsibility for ourselves and say, I'm continuing a pattern here, and I'm keeping myself a victim. And I don't have to do that. I can stop being a victim. So that was pretty much what my journey has been. And I wanted to write about that. And I didn't know how to write about that without telling the truth. If I tried to make the book easier to read or less personal or less revealing, I wouldn't have known how to make the statement that I wanted to make. So I took the easy way out and was totally honest and candid.
Let me just open the book for just a second. If you have the book, look at one of these first pictures in here. And I would like to know, right at the beginning of chapter one, I believe, part one, describe to me who this person is at this point. I am fascinated by this picture. She's a child I wouldn't want to cross.
Yeah, my caption in my head when I saw that picture once I was grown up, when I looked at it, the caption was, I'm all right, Jack.
Describe her to us. Who was she? Who is she?
Yeah, she's still alive in me, too. Her name was Edna Regaluli, which is the name I was born with. And by the time I was six, my mother had married three times. So having three fathers is having no father. When her third marriage ended, because it was, whatever year it was, 1939, I guess, it was hard to find a husband with two children. So we were sent to boarding school and kind of kept out of the way until she found her next husband. And then we were brought back. So I was six and sent not only to boarding school but out of the country. I was sent to Canada. To me, it was like being sent. I was exiled. And my brother was there too, but he was on the other side of the school. You know, it's funny, when I look at that picture, I can see that there is, about that child, a survivor. You know, that she was going to be all right. But I just really remember being scared to death and lonely. And being sent away to sleep in a dormitory with 40 strange girls and being tended to by nuns, some of whom were very sweet and kind and some of whom were really frightening. I'm surprised to see that look of all rightness on her face, because that's not the inner feeling. But it had to be there because I did survive and survive well.
When did you know? When did you know that she was going to survive?
I guess I always knew that. It's a very funny thing when you start feeling into your character, you know? I mean, if I look at myself as a character that I had to play in a play or movie, there's this dichotomy of insecurity and lack of a feeling of value, the feeling of being sent away by my mother. And at the same time, a feeling of adaptability. Like, okay, what's this new situation? How am I going to get along here? And I see that in her. So I mean, I'm very grateful to the genes I got, because along with a lot of the difficulties of my early life, I also got some gift of resiliency.
Well, there's a great sense through the book that you have a spine of sprung steel. I mean, you bend with it, you know, things hit you, they almost knock you over, but never all the way. Not quite. And then you spring back and continue on. And the way you do it, the forceful way you do it, almost digging into your heels and saying, I'm going ahead now, is just an amazing story. It's an amazing story of a life.
Yeah, I don't know how I got the nerve to do some of the things I did. I mean, when I left Detroit when I was 18, I got on a Greyhound bus with two suitcases and enough money to get to Dallas, Texas, and no money to survive once I got there. And when I think about that now, an 18-year-old, of course, it's a different world we live in, but even now, the idea scares me, and I think, what were you thinking, Edna Regularly? And I don't seem to have had a lot of fear.
It's a good thing we do these things when we're 18 and so.
Yeah.
You know, because if we did them when we were older, we would say, no, I don't think so.
Well, you think of all the reasons not to, but I had this really, I think the only clear ambition I ever had was to see the world. And very early on, I don't remember how early, but as long as I can remember, I had the goal to see as much of the world as I could possibly see. I think it was as early as reading Heidi and seeing her grandfather's cabin up in the mountains with the snow, and just the idea that it was so not Detroit.
Strange, I always equated the two. Yeah.
And I felt the same way when I went to the movies. And when I saw New York City for the first time in the movies, I went, oh, thank God, it's not all Detroit. So I just always wanted to see as much of the world as I could possibly see. And that that goal has been pretty well fulfilled. I haven't been to Japan yet or Machu Picchu. I still have to get to those two places, and Turkey. But I've seen most of the places I wanted to see and met those people, and, you know.
That seemed to be the more important thing, not just seeing the places, but, as you wrote about it, meeting the people and discovering what they had to offer the world and what you could learn from them.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing when you travel how it's like you're going through life with a lens, and then you get out in the world and the lens opens into a wide angle lens and more of the world comes in, and you get deepened and nourished and enriched by the difference, the otherness of people, you know, the ways that they live. I mean, I remember when I went to India, I was just like, wow, like in another planet, you know, it seems so different. And then, of course, you learn that everybody's pretty basically the same underneath all of the presentation. But the presentation is pretty spectacularly exotic and wonderful.
After leaving Detroit, going to Dallas, when in all of this did you determine, I want to be an actress?
Well, I was a model. I earned my
right.
living as a model. And it was kind of a distant thought that maybe someday I'd be an actress. And then one day when I was 24, I was already in New York. I was modeling and doing the Jackie Gleason show and doing commercials. So it was sort of on the fringes of acting. And one day I said to everybody I knew, I've made up my mind to be a model. I'm going to do a Broadway play this fall. Does anyone know how I can get an audition? And somebody got me an audition for a lead in a Broadway play, and I got the role. So that was my entrance into the theater, was a lead in a Broadway show. I do not recommend that as a way to start a career, because it turns out that you have to know more about acting than just what your native ability can lead you to do. And it took me a while to figure that out. But it certainly did launch me in the profession. And I've been an actress ever since. I can't even count the years. When was that? It was 1956. How many years is that?
50.
Right. Okay.
You got to work with Moss Hart as well, correct?
Well, Moss Hart was actually the backer of the first play, Fair Game. His friend, Joseph Hyman, was the producer, and he put all of his money into the show. Mm-hmm. And so he was there at the audition, and I met him, but he wasn't the director. When we were out of town, and the director needed to be, or they decided the director should be replaced, Moss Hart was there to kind of steady the ship for a few days, and his wife, Kitty Carlisle, who is now in her 90s and still singing in cabarets in New York, came to the theater and came up on stage, and it was a very troubled company. Everybody was mad at everybody else. There was a lot of wild things going on. And Kitty Carlisle came up and addressed us and said, "I have to go back to New York. I am leaving my husband here for a few days. If I hear that any of you give him any trouble at all, you're going to have to answer to me." I said, "Yes, ma'am." He had had a heart attack earlier, and she was very protective of him. Mm-hmm. He didn't stay long, as a matter of fact.
But didn't he have some kind words to say to you about your abilities?
Well, at the audition, when I came down the stairs from the stage, he said, he smoked with a cigarette holder. He was very elegant, and he said, "Where have you studied, dear?" And I said, "I haven't." And he said, "Oh, well, don't. You're a natural."
From Moss Hart, that's high praise.
Yeah.
Moving from Broadway, you did a lot.
Let me just say before you go into that, and that was right for that moment. The day came when I wanted to study, and I did,
right.
And I became a much better actress because of it, and I'm all for studying. I just didn't want to give the impression that I'm against studying.
Well, let's talk about that study right now. You stepped into the lead of a Broadway show right off the bat,
mm-hmm.
but you discovered that you wanted to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
You needed to learn more. And where did you go to learn?
Well, I worked for 10 years just on the basis of my talent, what I came in with. And then I was in Hollywood. I was making a film called Goodbye Charlie, starring Debbie Reynolds and Walter Matthau and Tony Curtis. And I was sitting on the set, and I looked around, and I said, "Well, this is it. This is the big time. I'm co-starring. Next step, I'll be playing Debbie Reynolds' part." And this voice in my head said, "I don't want it," which startled me. But I knew in that moment that I was dissatisfied with the direction my career was taking, that it was going to be at a certain level. I can't even say artistry, a certain level of performance without any real artistry. And I saw people around me who were artists, and I knew that they knew something I didn't know about acting. And all those people were from the Actors Studio. So I decided I wanted to go back to New York and study. So I went to Lee Strasberg, who changed my life.
Well, what kind of impact did Lee Strasberg and the Actors Studio have on your life? Have on your character, your talent, your performances?
All of that. You know, it's a funny thing. It's like we're like we can function all right at a certain level. And then once we say, okay, I want more than that, and we start diving down, it's like diving down into a sea where there's another sunken world. And that's what I swam into, this sunken world of like depth psychology, but translated into behavior, you know, so that I learned to study characters at the deep level, like what was really going on with them as human beings, and then how to behave in a way that the audience could understand what I understood. That's kind of the basis of method acting, what's called method acting. And that's such a wonderfully exciting and profound study, because you're studying the human psyche, and it's endless, you know. That sea is a very deep sea. And once I got into it, I didn't want to do anything else with my life. Being able to understand a character like, for instance, Mary Tyrone in Long Day's Journey Into Night, to really understand what is going on with her from her whole history, and to be able to behave on stage in such a way that the audience gets it, and I feel them get it. And there's this amazing exchange of energy, yeah, but it's like communion. I always think of it as communion, because I can feel the audience's understanding, and I know that that's what they came for, and it's what I came to share with them. And when they receive that offering, it's so profoundly human that it's why I'm an actress, and why I left that day in Hollywood when I said, I don't want it. I didn't know what it was I wanted. I didn't know what was calling to me, but I knew something really was. And I went to where I could find it.
Well, there is the idea that you can do just about anything with a kiss and a prayer. Yep. I can use my natural abilities, mm-hmm. you know, or be comic about something, or just touch it lightly and go, mm-hmm. and get away with it.
That's right.
But there is a danger in saying, I'm going to plumb into the depths and I'm going to be able to translate that to an audience. Mm-hmm. And the danger being that someone like me might jump in there and not be able to translate the character and stand on stage like a stick. Now, whereas when you did this, your natural abilities and the chance you took by going down and finding these characters led to roles like Last Picture Show, The Exorcist, which, despite the fact that it is a Hollywood horror film, is still affecting people mainly because, not because of the special effects, but because of the characters you created. Mm-hmm. And then on to Resurrection and other fine films that you've done. You know, is there a difference? You know, I'm getting to this question by going way
right.
Is there a difference between reaching down and creating those characters for the stage and finding that same depth and putting it on screen 40 feet high?
The internal process is exactly the same, because the real work is on that understanding of the humanness. And all of those characters are located within us. I mean, I believe, in my belief system, we all have everybody who's ever lived in us, the potential for them, from Jesus to Hitler. Under the right circumstances, we could find a spark of those characters in us. And once you accept that, as an artist, and you say, we're each a hologram of all of humanity, then you just go in and find where that particular form of humanity lives and isolate it and call it forth. the hard part is your ego. Your ego always wants to say, oh no, I could never be like that. I could never treat anybody that way. No, I couldn't play Medea. She killed her children, and I'm too nice for that. So as long as you let your ego win, you limit yourself completely as an artist to just what your ego likes, and your ego always likes the really shallow things.
The easy.
The pretty. Mm-hmm. So part of the training in taking this deep plunge is attuning yourself to when your ego is speaking and when your essence is engaged, and training yourself to know that your ego certainly has a job to do. I mean, it's the one that goes out and gets the work and pays the rent and has the confidence to say, I can do the job. It's not that you shouldn't have an ego. It's that when you get into the creative process, then you have to start juggling what's your ego and where's your artist. And your artist will always be willing to go places your ego doesn't want to go, which is what I had to do with this book.
We'll get to that in a minute. It's one of the questions that came from the audience. One thing I'd like to ask you is about your spiritual journey, mm-hmm. that you've taken. How has that changed in your life, and what point has it brought you to? What place has it brought you to?
Well, when I was sent away to boarding school, it was a Catholic boarding school, and I was brought up Catholic, and I was pretty devoted until a certain point in my life where things occurred in me that I knew were unacceptable to the church. And those things, like, for instance, sexuality, were too strong and too real for me to deny them. And so I said no to religion for a while, for about 10 years. And I pursued science, my reading. I was studying the behaviorists and other things, philosophy and so forth. And then I started to notice this ache I had. Sartre describes it as a God-shaped hole in the heart. And that's what I had. I had whatever I was studying did not do for me or to me what I used to feel as a child when I prayed. So I then set out on my own search for what would answer, what would fill that hole in my heart. And my studies took me into various religions and spiritual paths. And then I came upon the Sufis. And Sufism was originally the mystical branch of Islam in, say, 800 AD. But over the years, it's expanded and spread. And now it's all over the world. And there are Christian Sufis and Hindu Sufis and Jewish Sufis. And one of the definitions of a Sufi is a seeker of truth. And I felt like that's what I was really searching for. I wanted to understand what is the truth. And when I looked at various religions, they said, we have the truth, and nobody else does. And then this one said, we have the truth, and nobody else does. And what I found through my Sufi training is that the truth is in all of them. And there really isn't any need for war. There isn't any need to say, my God is the right God and your God is the wrong God. And that seemed to me to be a very big difference from all of the other paths I had pursued, that there is an inclusivity that says we are living inside an ineffable mystery. And nobody has all of the truth. the cosmos is too big and too miraculous. The creation itself is too mysterious and glorious to narrow it down to any one book. So what I found for me is that I could open all of the books and avail myself of all of the teachings and then find the similarities. I mean, the Buddha and Jesus said so many things that were exactly the same in the meaning, just the form was a little different. So I follow that path. I sometimes turn to the Bible. Sometimes I turn to the teachings of Buddha. Sometimes I go to the Hindu teaching stories. And there are many wonderful teachings in the Quran. So that's my path. And where my path has led me to is that the spirit lives in all of us. And we all live in spirit, both. And that there is a divine spark in each of us. And it's up to me to make contact with that spark every day, not out there, but in here, and to listen to it and be true to it and honor it and keep a place in me that is a sacred space and be as generous in the world as I can possibly be and be as authentic in my dealings with people and accept each challenge that comes toward me as a moment for me to be living through my integrity and not copping out on it when sometimes it would be easier to. So finally, it's that life itself is my spiritual path.
Let me take some questions from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And going along with this, this was one of your films that struck me deeply when I saw it. Continues to, even though I haven't seen it since it first came out probably 26 years ago, and that's Resurrection. Mm-hmm. That film, which I think is, well, it just knocks me out. Came from one of your own ideas, didn't it? A talk you were having with a friend?
I don't know what you mean by a talk I was having with a friend. It came from... I was presented with a script called Resurrection, not this script that we finally did. And I was in Greece making a film called Dream of Passion. Let me just ask, do we have to have it this warm? Is it possible for it to be cooler? Is anybody in control of temperature? Are you warm too? Yeah. Thank you. I was making Dream of Passion in Greece, and my agent called and said, there's a script called Resurrection I'm sending to you, and it's about Jesus Christ comes back to earth as a woman. I said, wow, I like that. That sounds wonderful. And then I got the script, and I didn't like the script at all, so I turned it down. And my agent said, well, the director and producer want to come and talk to you. I said, fine. So they came to Greece, and we met, and they tried to talk me into doing it. And they said, well, what don't you like about it? And I said, well, you know, it's an idea, but it's not an idea that's been realized. I mean, you have... It was an American school teacher goes to Jerusalem, and while she's there, she gets the stigmata, and her hands start bleeding. And, oh, isn't that a mystery? And, you know, nothing happened. And at that time, I was reading about the reemergence of the goddess in the consciousness. So I said, you know, ask yourself, what would it be if there was the equivalent of a carpenter, let's say a housewife, who found that she had some of the powers that Jesus had. Healing powers, for instance. I had recently had an experience with healing with my son had been injured from a horse, and we were in London, and his horse was badly scarred, and the doctor told me he was going to need skin graft. And don't aim it at me, aim it at the people. Thank you. And I took him to a healer, and he had a new face in 10 days. And I took him back to the doctor, and he said, oh, I never would have believed that face could look like that in 10 days. I said, well, I took him to a healer. He said, who did you take him to? And I said, Rosemary Russell. And he said, oh, yes, she's terribly good. So I was interested in healing, and I was reading a lot about it. And so I said, you know, let's just ask the question, what would that character be like? And under what circumstances would a housewife find herself with the powers to heal? Anyway, we talked a little more about it, and then the director said, well, that's a very interesting movie, but we have a green light from Universal to shoot this movie. Do you want to shoot this movie? I said, no. We said goodbye. They left. An hour later, the producers called and said, we like your movie better than our movie. And we'd like to start all over again with a new director and a new writer. And I said, yes, fine. So we found John Lewis Carlino, and he came to my house in New York, and we spent a few days together, and I told him all the stuff I was studying at the time. And he went away and wrote the script in 18 days.
That's what I was referring to.
I see. Thank you.
The whole idea of the healer and the responsibilities that came with it and the problems that came with it. It was a burden almost to the character, wasn't it?
I think she finally came to understand that healing happened through the power of love.
Right.
And that as long as she could reach out to the person who needed to be healed and love them, that then the healing came through. And I found that most of the healers that I've talked to would agree with that. It got to be difficult for her because the man that she loved couldn't accept it. He started projecting all kinds of things on her that weren't hers, and it ended in tragedy for him.
Will the film be coming out on DVD?
It is out on DVD, but Universal didn't release it right away, and I got so many letters from people, particularly healers, who wanted to use it in their seminars, and they were always writing to me and asking me if it were, if they could get taped somehow. So I sent the copies of the letters to Universal, and I said, I get letters all the time, and if you don't want to put it out on tape, why don't you release the rights to me and I'll put it out privately and make it available to people. And they immediately wrote and said, okay, we'll put it out on tape. And they did, but because it was 7 years after the film had been released, the stores didn't really stock it. But it is available. Whether or not it's on DVD, I don't know.
Okay.
But it is available on tape, but you have to order it.
All right. And it is on Amazon.com on VHS.
It is.
If you want it. What do you think about the continued trend in mainstream Hollywood to underrepresent real women, powerful women? There are a lack of roles and a severe lack of balance between the availability of female roles and male roles. Do you think this is changing for the better or the worse?
Well, I think it's changed somewhat. At the point that I made Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, it was a completely novel idea to tell a story from a woman's point of view. It had never been done. There were films where the woman was a protagonist, but it was always the male's version of the woman. And I was asking that we make a film where it was a woman's version of a woman. And that's been called a watershed in American film, and I think it was. And I think after that, it was possible for there to be more films that were made by women, more women directors, more projects that got on because actresses, people like Jessica Lange or Goldie Hawn, mm-hmm. other actresses, Barbara Streisand, wanted to make a particular film. So there has been movement, but I think there's no question that the number of films that are made for men, where it's a man's story, compared to the number for women, it's just very disparate. And that has to be a reflection of the culture, mm-hmm. you know, that we still have further to go in evaluating male and female people as equal and important beings.
One thing you mentioned I found very interesting, and that's the notion of a man's version or a man's vision of what a woman should be mm-hmm. in film. And the idea that women going to those films almost had to translate, you know, okay, this is a man's vision, now I'm translating it to what it really is in my mind. Okay, the movie is okay, or something along those lines. Does that still happen? Is it a man's business?
It's definitely a man's business. But there are some interesting female characters in film. I just saw Marty Scorsese's new film, The Departed,
right.
which is a totally masculine film. I mean, it's, you know, it's no woman would ever think to make that film. And yet there is one woman in it who is a really interesting character, who's a psychiatrist, and intelligent and educated and sexy, and you know, a good version of a woman. But there's one woman
right.
in a film with that many men.
Mm-hmm. And what I also enjoyed about that, she stood out. She was very, almost like a beacon at times within that film, and remained a very complex character. She was not, you know, very simple, here's the love interest, that's it.
Right. Right. Exactly.
How long did it take to write the book? How hard was it to gather it all together in your mind?
From the time, in 2000, I think, when I did Requiem for a Dream, and then there was an Oscar campaign, I gave a long interview to the New York Times, and a literary agent called me and said, you should write a book. And so from that point, where we found a publisher and I started formally writing, until now is 6 years. But I had been writing for a long time before that. I kept journals from the very beginning and diaries, and so I had a lot of resource material. And I actually started writing the book in 1980. And it was funny, when I started this version, I went back and reread all the diaries, which I had never done except for one small section. And I read all of my interviews, which I had never read. And I found that in the very first interview I ever gave after the opening of Fair Game in 1957, I said, well, I couldn't make up my mind if I wanted to be an actress, and I decided I'll act now and write later. So this is later, I guess. But the funny thing is that I have no memory of ever saying that or thinking it or feeling it. So it seems I made the decision to be an actress and write later, and then I totally suppressed the whole writing impulse except in my journals. And when people used to ask me to write something, I would say, oh, no, I can't write. No, I can't write. And I actually thought I had a writer's block, because every time I sat down to write something, it sounded like Betty Boop. And then in 1980, when my acting career took a little dip, I had this dream that my writing block had been lifted and that I was flooded with poetry all night long. And as I woke up, I could just catch the last poem. I lost all the others. I didn't remember those. But the last one said, Mama Moon, teach me to see like a poet and speak like a wild songbird, carrying words like grain in tight fists, food for a hungry wind. And I wrote that down in the morning. I went, well, that's not so bad. That's not Betty Boop. So I started writing then. And a lot of the stories that appear, particularly the childhood stories, I have versions of over and over and over. And then in 1990, I sat down to write a memoir. And as I wrote, I thought, oh, I kept saying, I can't tell that story. I better not tell that. Oh, gosh, no, I can't tell that. And then I decided, well, maybe it's a novel. So I rewrote it all in the third person. And so a lot of those versions are in various drawers and suitcases. So when they finally asked me to write a story, to write a book, I wasn't starting from scratch. I had been working at it for a long time.
In the end, did the book turn out the way you wanted it to? Or were you surprised by what you wound up with?
I'd like to rewrite the end. I found it was really hard to let go of it. I kept thinking, no, that's, you know, there's more. And finally, at a certain point, I just had to say, end it. You're never going to be happy with it. Just let it go. It is a little surprising. There are some surprises in it. And I think really that I'm not happy with the end because it's not the end. You know, it's an ongoing process. I'm still becoming myself. And I hope I continue to be my becoming until we do get to the end. But then when that happens, I won't be able to write it. So we'll have to settle for this.
Which of your movies is your favorite and why?
Well, you know, I like a lot of them, but Resurrection is my favorite because it had so much of what I wanted to say in it. It's a very special movie to me, and I know it affected people very deeply. I still get letters from people telling me that they became healers because of the film, or they went into various healing practices, or they were with their mother when she died, or their father because of the film. Many different aspects of the film have affected people, and after all, that's the reason for making a film.
On the flip side of that, many actors and actresses I've talked to over the years have said, you know, you'd bring up a certain film and go, oh, nope, don't want to talk about that one. That's, you know, some people have even gone as far as, like, that doesn't exist. That film does not exist. We will not talk about it. Are there any movies that you look at and say, oh, I wish I hadn't been a part of that?
A whole bunch of them. Yes.
Any you can mention?
No. Let's forget them. I mean, I was in, you know, there's a, for instance, a film I did called, I don't think I remember the name of it, but it was only shown in two drive-ins in the South once. I played my husband was a racing car driver, and I was his mechanic. And I had to weld, and that was the most interesting part of the film. I learned to weld. My favorite line in the film was, this guy came up to me and was surprised when I lifted my welding helmet that I was a girl, and he said in a sexy tone of voice, "Who ground your cans?" And I answered something like, this is not the right name, but it was something like, "Sullivan, who ground yours?" Now, I have no idea what either of those lines mean.
I don't either, but I wish I had written them. This question is, describe your experience in getting into the actor's studio.
Well, first I joined Lee's private classes, and I studied with him for a few years. And then I auditioned for the Actors Studio. When you audition, you do two auditions, a preliminary audition, and there are preliminary judges. They're members of the Actors Studio who do the judging. You do a five-minute audition, a five-minute scene with another partner. And I failed that audition. And then I heard through the grapevine, because the actor's studio is just loaded with grapevines, that Lee was very angry at the judges for failing me. And so I was encouraged by that. So I auditioned again, and I passed that time. And then I went to California. And by that time, the actor's studio had opened a West Coast branch. And Lee was spending 6 months in New York and 6 months in L.A. And I auditioned out there. I did a scene from Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. And Lee Grant was one of the judges, and she's now one of the artistic directors of the studio. And she told me that when I walked out on stage, I sat down at a dressing table, and I looked in the mirror, but there was no mirror there. I looked, you know, into the fourth wall, as they say. I just looked at myself in the mirror, and I was studying my face in this imaginary mirror. And Lee Strasberg whispered to Lee Grant, "You see, when it's right, they don't even have to speak."
Was every life has a series of turning points. You could have gone on in Detroit, you went to Dallas. You could have stayed in Hollywood and done year after year of Goodbye Charlies, you went to the Actors Studio. Different things have turned. Is there any one in particular, any particular turning point you say, you think, was the most important to you?
Probably that one. That one when I left Hollywood and went back to New York, because it wasn't just that I was making a decision to study with an acting teacher and be a better actress. It was that I was stating my priority in life, that I was making a commitment to be an artist, which I hadn't been. I was I was cute. And I think that decision, the decision to live the life of an artist, and of course ask me to define what an artist is, I'm not sure I would, but it's an inner commitment to your own creativity, to bringing forth your creativity and expressing as best you possibly can your deepest humanity. If there are any.
Does the audience have any questions that we haven't touched on? Yes, sir, in the back.
What we call method acting now, method was Lee's word. Stanislavski used the word system. And it really started at the Moscow Art Theater with Stanislavski. And it was basically to have real emotion on stage as opposed to indicated emotion. Instead of representing emotion, it was to really bring the real feelings on stage. And from the Moscow Art Theater, this was in the 1930s, early 1930s, there was the Group Theater in New York. And the Group Theater was the first really indigenous American theater that used that kind of system. And Strasberg was one of the founders of it with Harold Clurman and Cheryl Crawford. And Elia Kazan came up out of the Group Theater. He was one of the actors. And when the Group Theater folded after 10 years, and then Kazan didn't want to lose the that intensity of acting. He was afraid that the actors would just fall into commercial acting again. So he, along with a couple of other members of the Group Theater, founded the Actors Studio. And then 3 years later, they asked Strasberg to join him. So he came in, and then once he was there, he became the the spiritual and in every way the head of the Actors Studio. There were other members of the group theater who opened other studios and, you know, taught other people. And by the way, Marlon was involved with the studio as long as Kazan was involved. He was really Stella Adler's pupil. And he wasn't really one of Lee's students. I didn't approach it any differently. It was very, very challenging and difficult, but exhilarating. There's this incredible, weird paradox that when you're, or it is true for me anyway, I don't know if it's true for everybody else, but if I spend 5, 6, 7 hours crying and ripping my guts out and playing a character who's in utter despair, and I work all day doing that and keep myself in a state of absolute depression, when it's over, I just feel great. I can't explain it.
Yes, ma'am.
Charles Grodin was the funniest man I've ever known. I've never seen anybody who not only got a laugh on every line where a laugh was possible to be gotten, he got a laugh before the line. As, you know, if I asked a question and his answer was going to be funny, he would take a pause just before he answered and the audience would scream with laughter. He hadn't seen it. I never saw anybody else do that. I just adored working with him. We had a fantastic love affair on stage. When they wanted to do the film, I hoped that they would cast both of us. But in their usual short-sightedness, they only cast one of us. And they didn't cast Charles. That said, when they cast Alan Alda, they couldn't have cast a nicer, dearer, more wonderful fella. And I had a great time working with him in the film. It's kind of like having two marriages that are both very successful, you know, and one is over and then you have another wonderful marriage. It was like that. As far as the experience, the actor's experience, because the expression of what you're doing on stage is bigger than on film, I had to pull back a lot on my performance. And that was a little weird, but I think I managed.
Yes, sir.
Would you say that a little louder?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I understand what you're asking. One of the concepts that I've adopted is that we choose our life circumstances before we come in, that we decide where we're going to live and who's going to be our mother and father and our general circumstances so that we can best learn the lessons that we've come in to learn this time. That idea has been throughout history, as far back as Plato, who referred to it quite a bit. I like that idea. I don't even care if it's true or not. I adopt it as true. I choose it. Because in so doing, it means that I take full responsibility for my life. And for everything that happens becomes a lesson. I say, I'm here to learn something. Am I learning? Or am I being a victim and whining about what happened? And it's very easy to do that. It's very easy to say, well, they didn't treat me nice when I was little, and therefore I don't have any self-confidence, and therefore blah, 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 blah. And I don't see any growth happening that way. So having that point of view moves me from the victim position into a place where I take full responsibility for who I am. And if I see that my life isn't working for me, if I'm not being the person I want to be and doing the things I want to do, then I have to take steps to change that, whether it's go to therapy or go become a Buddhist or whatever you have to do to get a hold of your mind. Because your mind will, you know, it's got all these tracks laid down that got laid down before you had any choice in the matter. And they keep dictating how you react to life. And you don't even know that until you decide to have a look at it and say, why does this same thing keep happening over and over and over? What's consistent in all these different experiences? Oh, it's me. You know, there's a great Sufi saying, if you want to change your being, no, if you want to change your life, change your being. So how do you go about changing your being? Well, you go to therapy or you start meditating or you get some kind of spiritual practice or you go for help. You go to somebody who's a wise man or woman and you say, help me. I don't want to go on doing this anymore. My life isn't working. I want to change it. And you set out to do it and you do it. Because we really all have the ability to reprogram ourselves. We're not computers. If computers get programmed with bad software, they're stuck with it until one of us comes along and changes it. But that's not true of us. We have the ability to reprogram ourselves and we can do it. And that's really what the book is about.
You reach a point listening to Ellen Burstyn that you suddenly go, in some way, God is talking to me through her. You know, we've talked about the healing, the healer aspect, and as I listen to you and the things you've learned and the things that you are sharing, I find many of them hit my own life and the things I've wanted answers to lately in ways that I never expected.
Hmm.
You know, and I appreciate that. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for this book. And I thank you for this evening.
Well, you are very welcome.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for James McGreevy, Sina Jeter Naslund, T.A. Barron, Barack Obama, Eric Larson, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 1st, 2006.